Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel, and our gracious host, Mitchell High School. My name is Britta Cruz, registration number 41572, and I represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Lewis Ridgway. As this court is aware, there are two issues on appeal today, one concerning a prejudicial variance and the other concerning an erroneous jury instruction. I don't really think we can discuss one without discussing the other, so I do intend to address both of those issues today. I also intend to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. One other preliminary matter, I apologize for not appending the jury instructions to my briefs. I do have some additional copies here if the court would like them during the argument. If not, I'll just proceed. So taking things a bit out of order, I'm going to start with the second issue today, and that's concerning the instruction that failed to require a jury finding on a critical element of the possession of burglary tools charge. By statute, to be found guilty of possession of burglary tools, the prosecution must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, one, the defendant possessed items that could be used in a burglary, and two, the defendant specifically intended to use those items in the commission of a burglary. In fact, Chastain, Colorado Supreme Court case, makes clear that this specific intent to use the items in the commission of a burglary is the critical element of the crime. It's the gravamen of the offense. Without that, there is no crime. Here, however, the jury was never instructed, not in the elemental instruction nor any other instruction, that it had to find Mr. Ridgway specifically intended to use these items in the commission of a burglary. In other words, the jury only had to find that Mr. Ridgway possessed items that could be used in a burglary and that he intended to use these items for a purpose, but it was never required to find what that purpose was. Thus, presuming the jury followed the law as instructed, and that's what we must presume here on appeal, the jury was never required to find, as the law requires, that the prosecution had proven this essential element beyond a reasonable doubt.
Ms. Cruz, let me ask you, just if you would, and maybe you're getting here, if you would respond to Mr. McMaster's argument that the only reasonable reading of that would have been with intent to use the thing possessed for use in the burglary. They wouldn't have, you know, said you used it to, you know, reconstruct his house. I'd just like you to respond to the AG's argument.
Sure, Your Honor. I don't think that we can all sit here as the 13th juror. The jury in this case was instructed that it had to find Mr. Ridgway possessed items that could be used in a burglary and that these items was something that he intended to use. I think it's going a bit too far to assume the jury would have made a finding on an element that they were never instructed on. Now, opposing counsel points to the fact that this is a possession of burglary tools instruction. However, I would point the court to the other element that the jury was instructed on that required them to find that, in fact, these are items that could be used in a burglary. So a common sense reading of the instruction would be that, yes, these are items that maybe commonly used or adapted and designed for use in a burglary. They never had to go that further step as required by the law and as made clear in Chastain, that they have to specifically find that my client intended to use them in the commission of a burglary. That element isn't present. That is the critical element of the crime. It was disputed, and therefore this issue being preserved, it's impossible to say beyond a reasonable doubt that the lack of this critical element in the instruction was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Ms. Cruz, what about Mr. McMaster's contention that intent really wasn't an issue at trial, so there really was no error?
Well, I would disagree. Obviously, the thrust of the case was the burglary, and all the parties were focused on that. Now, the fact of what these tools were used for is in dispute because Mr. Ridgway said, I don't have anything to do with this. I am in the wrong place at the wrong time. I happen to be taking a ride home from a person who has just committed a burglary and there are burglary tools in the car. I had nothing to do with that. And I'd actually like to point out, Judge Dunn, that this is where the two issues intersect. Because part of the problem is that Mr. Ridgway was on specific notice of what the basis of the charges were. And he defended against those charges, only to have the prosecution change the playing field at trial unfairly to expand the scope of this charge. So now we have the jury considering an expanded charge, one that Mr. Ridgway didn't have an opportunity to defend against, and the jury could have based its finding on the items in the car. It could have based its findings on the items in Mr. Ridgway's pocket. The jury could have decided that they could agree to disagree and not make a finding about that. And I think that's the prejudice in this case, is we don't really know what the jury's finding was. They acquitted Mr. Ridgway of the burglary and theft, which I think indicates something here. It indicates that they did not believe that Mr. Ridgway was involved in this burglary, and therefore it fell to them to determine whether these items in his pockets may satisfy that charge. And that's what's so prejudicial here, is these are items in his pockets. Presumably a person intends to use the items in one's pocket for some purpose, but they never had to make that critical finding of what that purpose was. And that is critical. That is what makes not a crime a crime. And here the jury was allowed to convict Mr. Ridgway of something that wasn't a crime.
How, if at all, were the items that were in the defendant's pocket referred to in closing argument?
In closing argument, well, there's two things, Your Honor. First, we know that, contrary to the Attorney General's suggestion, the prosecution was making an argument that these items in his pockets would satisfy the conviction. She admitted as much when, in closing argument, she said, "Boy, I sure thought that mirror, which was discovered in Mr. Ridgway's pocket, was a burglary tool. That's why I asked Trevor Rich about it." And to my surprise, it ended up not being one. Then, in rebuttal closing, the prosecution went through, and her closing argument is more of a summary of the facts as opposed to a legal argument, but she focused on the gloves and the mask, and then she said to the jury, "And don't you forget the items in Mr. Ridgway's pockets." She talked about those, and then immediately after that she says, "I ask you to find him guilty on all charges."
But at least the AG's argument here is that the burglary tools were not, the pocket items were not used as evidence of burglary tools, and they point out the language you just did, said they're not burglary tools, and their argument is, as I understand it, that this just allowed the prosecution to tie, because Mr. Ridgway was saying, "Not me, I had nothing to do with this," it tied him to the burglary tools that were being charged, that he had these other similar tools, but those were not the burglary tools. Can you respond to, this goes, of course, to the variance issue. If they didn't use, well, maybe I'll ask first, if they didn't use the items in the pocket as burglary tools, would you agree that there's no prejudice on the variance issue, if they didn't use it at all?
Well, assuming that those facts are true, which obviously I dispute, right. I do believe they could have relied on them.
Okay, so then I appreciate your candor there, and I understand you disagree. So, in here, I guess, would you respond to the AG's argument, you know, that they didn't use the burglary tools, the pocket items as evidence of burglary tools? They didn't. They used it only to tie Mr. Ridgway to the crime that he was charged with.
Well, I think the prosecution's statement in closing and also the evidence she elicited at trial completely belie that reading of the record. The prosecution did not limit its examination to the items that she had charged in the charging documents. She went beyond that in asking Trevor Rich about other items, including items discovered in Mr. Ridgway's pockets, to elicit testimony and to explain to the jury how these items are items that could be used in a burglary. For instance, she asked the question about the mirror. Now, it appears she later abandoned that argument once the testimony didn't go her way, but in addition, she asked testimony about the walkie-talkies. How were they used? And Trevor Rich testified they were used in keeping in communication and committing this alleged burglary. I think that is evidence that the prosecution is now expanding the scope of its charge. It wasn't just merely eliciting this evidence to link Mr. Ridgway to the burglary. And then in closing, as I already explained, the prosecution admitted as much, that she intended to argue that these other items could be relied upon by the jury. And I'd like to also point out that, you know, this wouldn't really have been much of a problem if the judge had simply given the instruction that defense counsel tendered. It was a proper instruction on all counts and included the charging document language. And had the jury been given that instruction, they would have been precluded from consideration of that additional evidence. You know, defense counsel never objected to the evidence coming in. That's not the issue. We would have no reason to believe that the jury would rely on this as the basis for the charge. because we'd already been placed on notice of what the basis of the charge was, and in good faith we defended against that specific charge. And had the jury been given the instruction that we tendered, there wouldn't have been a problem here. But the judge did not, and the instruction ended up being faulty in not one but two respects. And I think it casts a dark cloud over the verdict in this case. I think if the court had given our instruction, that I wouldn't be standing here today, because there is a reasonable possibility that Mr. Ridgway would have been acquitted of this offense.
Counsel, you've got about 4.5 minutes left. I know you wanted to save about 5 minutes. So I don't mean to interrupt, but you're kind of where you wanted to be.
I'll take the time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. On behalf of the people of the state of Colorado, my name is Michael McMaster, registration number 42368. I'm going to start with the variance issue and then move on to the jury instruction issue.
Actually, Mr. McMaster, I want to maybe flip your order a little bit.
Certainly.
Can I ask you, is it the people's contention that submitting an alternative jury instruction is not sufficient to preserve the issue for appeal?
In this case, it was insufficient.
And why is that?
Because it failed to provide adequate notice to the court of the grounds of defendant's objections. With respect to the jury instruction, because the analysis for each issue in terms of preservation is different here. If we look at the Paul case, for example, in that case it was a securities fraud case, and the defendant's defense in that case was that the investment contracts that he was selling were not securities, and they tendered instructions which included a definition for what a securities is. So it was central to the defendant's case, and this court held in Paul that tendering those definitions were sufficient to preserve the issue. Here, tendering the instructions was insufficient because the court had no notice of the innocent purpose argument that we're now talking about here.
But by virtue of the fact that an elemental instruction was provided with a mens rea requirement, doesn't that put the child to a prejudice?
No, Your Honor. Respectfully, I disagree that it doesn't in this case, particularly because of the circumstances that the defendant never once advanced this innocent purpose argument that, those tools are, I'm building a house and I'm going skiing and that's my ski mask. It was, in fact, not the defense case at all. So it wasn't. The court wasn't on notice that this was an issue. Now, admittedly, the preservation issue is closer with the jury instruction than with the variance issue, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Can I just follow up on that a little
certainly.
Bit? If I may interrupt, could you pull the microphone a little closer to you? I'm having trouble hearing you.
I apologize.
No problem. Thank you. I'm sorry, Judge. Assuming we disagree with you on the preservation issue regarding the instructional issue, would you agree that the standard that we apply is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, the constitutional harmless error standard?
No, I would disagree.
Talk to me about that a little bit.
Sure, it's the standard harmless error.
And why is that when you're talking about an actual instruction as to an element of the offense itself?
Well, that's the analysis that was adopted in the Supreme Court's Nieder case. And again, if we look at both the Paul case and the Rice case, the language that they cite is that standard harmless error review, not the constitutional harmless error review. Defendant cites in the reply brief the Welsh case. The Welsh case actually has a nice discussion about the differences between the two. In this case, both with variance and the jury instruction, assuming that the issue is not preserved, it's the standard harmless error.
Aren't those cases distinguishable because they didn't deal with an element? Can you cite me any case where an element of the offense was omitted and the court said it wasn't constitutional harmless error review?
I think there's a number of cases to be cited. The one that I do cite in my brief is People versus Akers. That's at 746 P. 2nd, 1381. And that goes to the harmlessness of the error. Presuming that we do have an error, which the people obviously dispute, if it is an instruction as to an undisputed issue, then omission of that element is harmless. And that is exactly what we have here. The the defendant now, for the first time on appeal, is arguing this innocent purpose argument, but that was not an issue which the defendant raised at trial. Therefore, if we assume that the jury instructions were erroneous, they were harmless because it wasn't an issue in dispute.
But, I mean, is it a question of whether the defendant raised the issue in trial or whether that's just part of the prosecution's proof? You can't convict without proving this element, and the element, as stated in the statute, is different from what the jury was actually instructed on. So whether or not the defendant raised the argument, how do you win without proving that element beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, it would have been better practice to include it, but that doesn't itself make it reversible error. And as this court and our Supreme Court has made clear, if it's an undisputed error, an omission, even as to a critical mens rea element, is harmless if it's not been in dispute.
But where in the record did Mr. Ridgway concede that he intended to use any burglary tools for purposes of committing a burglary? I mean, that the cases that you're talking about that deal with it's undisputed, it's literally undisputed, sometimes stipulated that that's not an issue. Here, Mr. Ridgway's whole theory of the case was like, wrong place at the wrong time. I had nothing to do with this. And the jury is never told they have to find that he intended to use burglary tools for this particular purpose. I mean, I understand the argument you're trying to make, but I'm having trouble, frankly, understanding how this was not disputed, or stipulated to, which is kind of, I think, where the cases go, where then it's harmless, where truly no one's disputing this. He clearly wasn't admitting that he had the requisite mens rea. He's saying, I wasn't even involved at all.
Are you referring to the Rice case in terms of the stipulation? Because I certainly agree that the defendant didn't stipulate.
Yeah, well, there's a number of cases, and I mm-hmm. think just, I mean, you're telling us now that intent wasn't an issue, but I'm having trouble understanding how intent, you know, how it really wasn't an issue. And his argument is, you can't prove any of this. That's basically his position, because I didn't do anything here. Wrong place, wrong time.
Well, respectfully, I wouldn't characterize the defense cases, the defense case that way. Certainly, there are other circumstances to consider when we're talking about the harmlessness, including the evidence that was presented against the defendant. Most notably, his statement to Detective Miller, "You know, you've got us in the car full of burglary tools." You know, he actually used the term of art, burglary tools, which is something I don't even use in everyday conversation. And, you know, I think from there, we certainly his use of the term burglary tool, you can infer both his possession, but also the intent to use in a burglary.
But doesn't the jury have to be instructed on that? I mean, in the hypothetical case, I mean, I do remember the testimony you're talking about.
Sure.
But, you know, a reasonable juror could say, well, this doesn't look good. You know, that all he was saying is, gee, this doesn't look good for me. You got me stuck in a car with a bunch of burglary tools. I mean, a reasonable juror, it seems to me, instructed properly, could have bought that, said, you know, I'm really concerned here. This looks bad. I mean, maybe that's the context for it. I mean, and again, my concern, frankly, is without that instruction, we're here to guess, and that's troubling.
I understand the court's concern, but I want to be careful not to conflate the question of whether or not there was an error versus any prejudice that error might have had, assuming we have the error.
Let me ask you one more question
sure.
on that, and then I'll stop taking up all your time. You make the argument, I think, that a reasonable jury would have figured out from the context or whatever the instruction that it had to be intent to use the thing possessed for the purpose of using it in a burglary.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm not sure what in the instruction would lead you to, could allow us to make that conclusion. Maybe you can help me out with that argument.
Sure. So first and foremost, we have the context of the evidence that the instruction was provided afterwards, and you know it's the context being evidence of a burglary and burglary tools. You know, we have the actual title of the instruction, which is possession of burglary tools. There's also the preceding line where the defendant asserts that in the commission of such offense is missing, which has the phrase an offense involving forcible entry. So I think the context in any fair common sense reading would imply that the individual would have to possess those tools with the intent to use in a burglary, not that they would have the intent to use for some innocent purpose.
Mr. Professor, how do you square that with the fact that the jury acquitted him of perpetrating?
Well, they're two different crimes, Your Honor. Certainly, they could have assumed he didn't commit this burglary. They didn't find Trevor Rich's testimony to be credible as to the burglary here, but based on the evidence of finding him in the car with those with the tools, that they were on their way to commit another burglary. They're two separate crimes, so his acquittal in one really I don't think has any weight when we're talking about his conviction of the possession of burglary tools.
Was there any evidence in the record that there was another crime under contemplation?
No, Your Honor, but
it's theorizing that that's a possibility.
Right, and to think the other way is also theorizing, and as my opposing counsel correctly pointed out, you know, we're not the 13th juror, and we really shouldn't be speculating as to the deliberative process of the jury. They did, however, find him guilty of the possession of the burglary tools, which has a different set of elements than burglary. So his acquittal as to the burglary, I think, holds very little weight here.
I don't understand your argument about how the title of the instruction helps us here at all. I mean, carrying it to an extreme, would it be okay if the person was being charged with murder and the title of the instruction was murder, and the court left out the mens rea element?
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have the citation to the case with me here, but there is, in my brief, a case cited that is, in fact, very similar to there, where it is a murder case and the mens rea was left out. And what is required is not that the jury elements match exactly the statutory language. All that the law requires is that the instruction, read as a whole, adequately inform the jury of the law. So the case that I'm referring to there, in a definitional section on a different instruction, provided enough information for the court to determine that the jury was adequately informed of the law.
So that's helpful here, and I guess that's really the issue. You're telling us we have to look at the other instructions to be able to make the logical leap that there's enough in there that would tell a reasonable juror that this is really what is meant here.
That's the issue we have to decide. That's absolutely correct,
so
Your Honor.
What other instruction are you talking about? I mean, there's the Johnson case you're talking about, and
yes,
as I recall, the mens rea was put in a whole different instruction, but it laid out all the mens rea for murder. And so what other instruction can we look at in this case? I mean, I don't think you identified one in your brief that fills this hole, that fills in this hole.
So this isn't exactly the same as the Johnson case, where there's in fact some other, you know, jury instruction 35 that has the magical answer here. But the point being, and as the court went through in Johnson, is that when you read the instructions as a whole, if that provides, you know, to the jury, it adequately informs the jury of the law. So here, when we read the instructions as a whole, which includes the title, it also includes the instructions for the burglary charge itself, which I think also provides additional context and information to the jury. If we could briefly talk about the variance issue, again, the people assert that this issue is not preserved. The analysis is a little bit different than with the jury instruction, because, you know, at bottom, a variance claim is about notice of the evidence to be presented at trial. And here, at no point in time did the defendant object to any of the evidence that he now complains of. So with that said, as to the substance, there isn't an actual variance. The evidence of the items in his pocket was mostly presented as circumstantial evidence to the other charges, and only two of those items were really discussed at length, one being the walkie-talkie and the other being the mirror. The walkie-talkie was used to connect the defendant to the Jeep, which contained the burglary tools. There wasn't any evidence presented to say that the walkie-talkie itself was a burglary tool. And I have to take issue with my opposing counsel in saying that the testimony of Trevor Rich was that he said we use them to communicate in the commission of this burglary. That's not true. In fact, all he did say was that we use them to communicate. It wasn't bounded by time or event. And then the other item that was discussed was the mirror, and obviously there, in that case, the testimony was that it was not a burglary tool. So I don't think it's appropriate for the defendant to rely on that to show that there's a variance, because the evidence that was presented at trial showed that it was not a burglary tool. Additionally, the evidence that was presented included the testimony of Trevor Rich, who identified the crowbars, mats, and gloves as burglary tools, and the two arresting officers, both of which identified the items in the Jeep, being the crowbar, mask, and gloves, as the burglary tools. And no point in time does the record support an inference that the evidence showed or even suggested that the items in Mr. Ridgway's pockets were burglary tools. So there, we don't even have a variance. But assuming that we do, he lacks prejudice for it to be for that error to be reversible.
Can you cite me? You talked about surplusage in your brief. Best I can tell, the Supreme Court cases that you cite, and Sterone and cases like that, deal with where the indictment pleads more elements and they get a trial and they put on evidence of less. Here, for whatever reason, the DA charged real specific, these items, and then put on something different. Assuming there was burglary tools, wouldn't that be a variance? Now, how is that surplus?
I see my time's up.
Question,
okay. I do want to make a quick point of clarification that the charging document here was an information and not an indictment.
Right.
And in fact, both myself and the defendant equivocate in our briefs, and I apologize for that. But the factual circumstances are, as I read the rules and cases, are more limited within an indictment. The specific answer to your question is that, no, I can't cite you to an exact case that's exactly like this. The Rodriguez case is an example where in the charging document, the individual was charged with sexual assault by sexual penetration, and the charging document listed two means of sexual penetration, and then the jury instructions included, I think, five different means of sexual penetration, and that was held to be non-prejudicial error. So with respect, I respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Cruz, you have some time for rebuttal, and I think I'd ask the clerk to give you another 45 seconds in case you want to use it. Just okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay, just a couple of quick points. Maybe just starting with the last point there that opposing counsel made about Rodriguez. Rodriguez is distinguishable from this case. In that case, as opposing counsel noted, the defendant had been charged with specific acts of sexual misconduct, and then the instructions sort of expanded that. But as the court noted in that case, the defense would not have been any different had it been one type of sexual misconduct and not the other. The court specifically noted that. And, pardon me. And also the defendant in Rodriguez, it appears that on appeal didn't make any arguments as to how his defense was prejudiced. Here Mr. Ridgway has explained repeatedly in the brief that he was on specific notice of particular charges, he in good faith defended against those charges, and when the crime was expanded he was left without a defense. That is why this case is like Rice and not Rodriguez.
Can you respond to Mr. McMaster's contention that the instruction alone was not sufficient to preserve the variance?
Yes. I think the contemporaneous preservation rule serves a specific purpose, and that purpose is a good purpose. And here, defense counsel's action in tendering the instruction served that purpose. There would have been no reason to object to the evidence coming in at trial when we'd already been put on notice of what the basis of the charges were and led to believe that the jury would not be resting its verdict on those, on anything but those items. We did not tender a stock instruction. I'd like to point that out. This was a conscious decision by defense counsel to include the charging language in the instruction, and I think the evidence is defense counsel's position that the jury should be limited to only consideration of what the prosecution charged. And I believe that places the court on notice of a problem here, and the court should have been given that instruction to prevent this variance from prejudicing Mr. Ridgway.
Had the court given that instruction, the jury would have been precluded from consideration of that evidence as the basis of the charge. Certainly, they could rely on it if they wanted to use it to connect Mr. Ridgway with the burglary. However, the jury appeared to have rejected that argument because it acquitted him. So I hope that answers your question. I'd like to point out that opposing counsel seems to view this case as something that it is not. This is not a case where we get discovery and we see that there are possible bases for the offense. And then it's incumbent upon defense counsel to refer a bill of particulars so that defense counsel knows what the charges are and how to prepare a defense in the case. This is a case where the prosecution went ahead and specifically elected the basis of its charge. Had this been a situation where we requested a bill of particulars, the prosecution absolutely would have been limited at trial to proof of that evidence. And I don't see the situation as any different. I would dispute opposing counsel's reading of the record in terms of Trevor Rich's testimony about the walkie-talkies. He does explicitly say on page 151, in, I believe, that first day of trial, January 14th, that they used the walkie-talkies in the commission of this offense, and the jury rejected that my client was involved, but could have used that testimony to infer that these walkie-talkies are items that could be used in a burglary. Now, of course, they never had to go the extra step as required by law to find that he did, in fact, intend to use it in a burglary. Just to touch base very briefly on the standard of review, of course, I do believe this constitutional harmless error. The case law in this area is well-established, long-standing precedent. If this court were to apply a different standard of review, I believe it would conflict with years of precedent from this court and the Colorado Supreme Court. Specifically, a case cited by opposing counsel Johnson, the missing mens rea element, the court applied the constitutional harmless error test in that case and found that although the elemental didn't have the critical mens rea, another instruction very clearly did. And so in that case, there could be no possibility of confusion. Here, there most certainly was reason for confusion because a whole element was missing. And the jury is given an expanded crime in which to convict Mr. Ridgway. And I think the combination of these two problems require reversal in this case. And finally, there is discussion here as well. What was the jury thinking? We're kind of guessing here, we're guessing there. Well, it's my position that if we're guessing at all, then Mr. Ridgway's convictions need to be reversed. The jury wasn't required to find a critical element, and I don't believe we can assume that they did. I see I've run out of time, so I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Ridgway's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cruz. I thank you to both counsel for your helpful and excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted. We will issue